So I read an article you wrote a few weeks ago already about the agreement that was signed between the government in Mali and some groups representing the Tuareg rebellion. So this is important because there will be elections, or there are supposed to be elections in Mali by the end of the month. So what
That's
is
right.
what do you think about this accord that has been signed?
Well, I think I think a lot of pressure was put on everyone, all the parties, to sign it because the elections are considered to be absolutely crucial by, especially by America and France, and so I think they're really, you know, probably in a soft way, kind of bullying the French and also the Tuareg rebel movement into, sorry, the Malians and the Tuareg rebel movement into having this agreement, because without it, the elections wouldn't really be possible, or they'd be possible, but they wouldn't be very legitimate, you know. So,
why do they put this pressure? Is this humanitarian reasons, or?
I think they feel that nothing can move forward in Mali unless there is legitimate power in Bamako, and also a legitimate civilian, a political power that basically has the power to control the army, you know, which has been the problem since March of last year, because even though Captain Sonogo and his putschistas have taken a back seat officially since, you know, the middle of last year, it's been widely accepted that they've been manipulating the political situation in Bamako. So I think many Malians and also many people in Washington and Paris want this situation to end. They want a legitimate power, and they feel that only once legitimate power is there, that they can start rebuilding and also financing a rebuilding, you know, because as some of the listeners may know, America forbids any foreign aid to governments that are not democratically elected, you know, which is ironic considering the situation in Egypt and the Egyptian army, but I think that's the official rule anyway in Washington. So they want to fund Mali, and they can only fund Mali if there's a legitimate democratic government there.
And they can't wait to start funding Mali again. So,
well, I think they want Mali. That, you know, they feel that Mali is a potential. There's all this kind of very dramatic statements, like Mali is the new Afghanistan.
Indeed, since a few years already, I hear that comparison.
Yeah, and you know, it's not. It's a bit of an easy comparison, and it's a bit of a false comparison in many ways. But you know, the governments of the Western powers don't want another place where angry young men get turned into jihadists and potentially attack their interests, you know, so they want to try and sort out Mali. But, you know, obviously the reality is much more complex than that. And, you know, there are many people who are wondering whether these elections are too soon, whether Mali is ready for elections, whether there aren't other conversations that need to be had before elections are held. And also whether, you know, at times the West is a little bit obsessed with democracy as an essential cure for every evil, whereas the actual needs of people in Timbuktu, in Gao, in Kidal are much more basic in a way. They have basic needs of being able to live, of being able to, you know, earn money and feed their families. And these are more essential than democracy, which is a kind of a higher aspiration once you've sorted all those things out. So, you know, this is the debate that's going on, basically, you know.
So why would the elections be too soon?
Because the problem with Mali since 1960, when it became an independent state, is that it's been badly constructed. The relationship of its many different parts to the centre has not been properly thought out. It needs to find a form of statehood and nation that satisfies the very peculiar nature of its territory, where there are many, many different people speaking many, many different languages, and some of whom, you know, especially the Tuareg and to some extent the Arabs, don't feel particularly part of this great undividable nation called Mali, you know. So if they want peace, they need to find a new kind of format, as it were, you know, and...
Like a federal state, maybe, like Belgium.
Yeah, exactly. Federalism or regional autonomy or, you know, the canton system in Switzerland or, you know, or the Länder Switzerland system in Germany. You know, a very clever kind of peace worker who I spoke to once said, why does Mali always look at France as its model? And as people may know, France is very centrist. You know, everything is tied to the centre in France. Everything is tied to Paris. And just over the border, they could look at Belgium or they could look at Germany, where you have different Länder and each Länder has a little parliament and it can raise a certain amount of local taxes and this kind of thing, you know. And so maybe Mali needs to look at these models, spend some time and come up with a system that will allow it to exist peacefully and with all its incredible diversity, because it is a very huge place with very different peoples in there, you know. And it also crosses this cultural and geographic divide, which is what the Sahel is, between the Arab Berber north and the Black African south. And every country that sits on that divide has always had problems. Look at Sudan, look at Chad. So this is a big problem that needs solving, and it's not going to be solved by one election. So,
Is there talk about a new state system in this agreement?
I don't think so, no. I think the agreement basically is... I think the agreement basically promises talks about talks, as it were, but I don't think there's any specific kind of clauses that promise anything once the election had been made, because obviously once the election had been made, first you'll have a new president, then you'll have a new assembly, and anything that gets passed needs to be passed by that new assembly. So any deal that's made now cannot make a lot of promises, because they simply don't know who will be in power to ratify those promises. Do you see what I mean?
Okay, so what is the value of the agreement then? What does it say?
I think the value of the agreement is just to allow the Malian army to get back into Kidal, which is causing quite a few problems. I mean, in the last two or three weeks, there's been quite a lot of low-level tension between local Kidal people and the Malian troops, who, from what I've heard, don't really go much beyond their barracks. And there's also this MINUSMA, this UN force, which is there. I think basically the agreement allows that situation to take place, you know, and sort of makes certain guarantees about MNLA troops and MNLA personnel and that kind of thing. But I don't think it really has much in terms of really, really long-term solutions to the problem in it.
No, except that I read that there is some mention of respect for human rights.
Yeah. What agreement nowadays doesn't have something about respect for human rights? I mean, I think that's the kind of basic sine qua non. The fundamental problems are there, they're still there, and nothing that has been done so far has addressed them.
No, and also, I think the agreement has been signed by the MNLA, which is the main secular Tuareg rebellion group, and has been signed by the government, and then by this new... institution that is representing the most powerful clan leader, I think. But the people who caused the problem, so the armed Islamistic groups, did of course not sign this agreement. And where are they, and aren't they going to cause trouble?
Yeah, they are there now. And
they're still in Mali.
Yeah. There were a lot of foreign fighters, Egyptians, Mauritanians, Algerians, Tunisians, even Pakistanis, who fought in northern Mali last year. And I can imagine most of them have gone, and a lot of them, by all accounts, have gone to Libya, especially southern Libya, which is a very comfortable place for them to be at the moment, unfortunately. But there were also a lot of local fighters, and those local fighters were not only Arabs or Tuareg, they were also Songhai. You know, I've heard that even some Bambara were part of the Islamist militias, you know.
Yeah, so those are black ethnic groups
black
from
ethnic
the south.
Groups, yes. Yeah. And they've just gone home. Or they've been caught, or they've been killed, or it's too difficult for them to go home because people know who they are and they fear retribution. But, you see, the thing is that Islamism, it always arises out of a society which is there, and it arises out of social issues and social problems. like cancer in a body is the cells of the body turning into something else. And everybody knows how difficult it is to fight cancer, because it's not like a thorn that's been stuck out into your skin and you can take the thorn out and then everything is okay. It's part of your body. You know, it has arisen out of your body. And that's the same for me, for Islamism. And Islamism is a response. You know, it's either a completely cynical, opportunistic kind of smokescreen for other activities like drug smuggling and stuff like that, which in certain cases it is. But it's also a response to political ineptitude, corruption, to residual colonialism and all these things. And so those issues have to be addressed in order for Islamism not to take hold.
Okay, just to make things sure, Islamism is not Islam. You mean the fundamentalistic
side of it? Yeah, so-called Salafism or Wahhabism, or, you know, it's got all these names. It's a doctrine which sometimes turns into armed struggle, sometimes doesn't. And it's like an extreme, very rigorously, what we call fundamentalist, puritanical is another word you could use, form of Islam. And it is not Islam. It's just like Calvinism is not Christianity. It's the same. Because Islam is a huge body of different cultures and different peoples who adhere to a central kind of system, but they adhere to it in their own way. Well, I read something which I thought was very interesting the other day, which is one of the reasons that Islam has been able to spread so far and wide and exist in so many different places, from Tashkent or Uzbekistan in the east to Senegal in the west, is because Sufism was so open to local culture colouring the form of devotion that people practice. And so in a way, it's Sufism that has allowed Islam to spread so far and wide. And the Wahhabi ideal is that Sufism is bad and that you must get rid of all the kind of local cultural input into Islam and just absolutely follow to the letter, to the rigor, Islam as it is practiced in Saudi Arabia, not even the whole of Saudi Arabia, in the central part of Saudi Arabia, you know, as when it originated, is a kind of completely mad idea in a way. So that's what it's based on. And sometimes it turns into violent struggle.
Well, it always surprises me how this could take root in the Tuareg society, which has, I think, one of the most easygoing interpretations of Islam, and especially with a very strong position of women.
Absolutely. I mean, it surprises me as well. But from what I can tell, it's a very, what we might call, bourgeois phenomenon. Because it's rather wealthy, well-connected, senior Tuaregs, and only a few of them who got into this philosophy in the 1990s, including Yad Agali, most famously the rebel leader who started the Islamist militia, Ansar al-Din, which in a way, it's his action which drew the whole of that rest of that community into trouble, into allowed this image as the Tuareg, as kind of Islamist terrorists, to arise in the mind of the world. And the Tuareg that I've spoken to, I don't know, it's probably the same with you, are absolutely livid, angry with that man for having done that.
Yes, and I suppose many Tuareg women are especially angry at him.
Absolutely. Now, understand.
Another thing that keeps fascinating me is that nobody ever talks about where their money comes from. Every now and then you read, yes, the Islamist groups have more resources than MNLA, but nobody ever says where those resources come from. They're not coming from God, I suppose.
No. Well, maybe the Islamists will tell you they are, but no. I mean, the official answer is that they come from illegal activities. The ACME, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and before them the GSPC have been involved in for the last 15 years. So that includes smuggling and that includes kidnapping and stuff like that. But if you actually sort of try and sit down with an envelope and make the calculation of how much money they must have needed to fight their rebellion, to take over the north of Mali, to run the north of Mali for 10 months, to buy all the arms that they did, etc., etc. You know, that is actually a rather huge sum of money, and I don't believe that the sums add up in a way. So there must have been other input. And this is the big question, where did that come from? Well, there are a number of theories, but these theories, having read endless articles on this very subject, I've never seen more concrete evidence than you could jot down on the back of a postage stamp, to be honest. The theories are that they come either from rich individuals in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and that kind of thing, or they come from certain Middle Eastern governments, especially Qatar, who everybody supposes has an interest in seeing this kind of hardline Sunni Wahhabi Islam spread in that part of the world. Other people think it comes from Algeria, because Algeria was very, very worried, has always been very, very worried about the idea of an independent Berber state, a Tuareg state, basically, on their southern border, because they have so many problems controlling Berber Amazigh aspirations in their own country.
Sure, and if one state allows a part of its country to be independent, then the Tuareg in the other countries will want to the same thing.
Exactly, that's the theory, that's the fear. So a lot of people think that Algeria has been financing these groups for a long time in order to confuse and infiltrate and subvert the Tuareg cause, or the Berber cause, if you like. Those are some theories, but as I say, it's the elephant in the room when you talk about this whole issue, because it
yes.
seems likely that money has come from one or some of these sources at some point. But how it's come, exactly from who, nobody knows. And without that kind of evidence, journalists, people like myself and maybe yourself, it's very difficult for us to talk about it, because it's like talking about the Loch Ness Monster, or, you know, did Lee Harvey Oswald assassinate JFK or not? You know, it's on that level. So,
anyhow, it strikes me that there's never any talk about this, and that makes me suspicious and makes me think that probably there is no investigation, because the investigation would lead to countries or people who are officially partners of the West.
I don't think there's not any talk about it, because I've been obsessively reading stuff from all kinds of sources on this for about 2 years, and there has been quite a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of articles about what is Qatar doing, what is the Algerians doing, are the Algerians behind the GSPC? I mean, there's this famous British anthropologist, Professor Jeremy Keenan, you know, he's written books on the subject, which cause a lot of controversy. There is a discourse about all of this, but there's just very little evidence. There's tangential evidence. I mean, apparently, the interim president of Mali, John Kunda, went to Qatar sometime in the last year and said to the Qatari authorities, stop funding jihad in my country, which is an extraordinary thing. I've not had any independent confirmation of that, of exactly what was said, exactly what the answer was. So, you know, you just, as a journalist, as an outside observer, which unfortunately most of us are, it's just very, very difficult to get to the bottom of it.
Okay, so we have to wait and see what's going to happen there now. Kind of president will be elected, and then it's probably up to this person what the policy will be after that.
Exactly. But I would really urge that person to take a step back and to have the courage to find really long-term solutions rather than just play to the streets. And I think that's the danger, because, I mean, for understandable reasons, people in southern Mali are very, very angry towards the Tuareg, very angry towards the Arabs as well. You know, that's why a lot of Tuaregs and Arabs have had to flee cities like Timbuktu and Gao. But, you know, the politicians must slightly rise above that, you know, and say that if they want their country to exist as it is for the next 200 or 300 years, they have to find an intelligent solution to keeping all these people sort of more or less happy and more or less functional within the borders of their state, you know.
Okay, we'll see. Now, you are writing, or you wrote a book with an intriguing title, that's Music, Culture and Conflict in Mali. I think you first came to Mali in connection with music.
Yes, I first went in 2001 to attend the first festival in the desert, which is an event that's now become quite famous around the world, and this was the first one, so that was an amazing trip. So yeah, definitely with music, yeah.
So what is the book about? What's the link between music, culture and conflict in Mali?
Well, it's obviously, famously, the Islamist militias in northern Mali banned music last year, officially, because it contravenes their Wahhabi doctrine. And this is an extraordinary thing to do in a place that lives and breathes music. Music is the lifeblood of daily life, of a life, indeed. Music will accompany you at your birth, at your marriage, at your death, and at all points in between. And also, Mali, music represents Mali. Mali is one of these countries like Jamaica or Ireland where people know very little about it if it's not via music. Stop 10 people in the street of any European city and say, who's the president of Mali? They won't be able to tell you, but say, name me one Malian musician, they might be able to say Salif Keita or Tinari Wen or Oumou Sangaré or someone, you see. So it's an extraordinary thing to do, to ban music completely from this territory. And so I felt basically this whole project arose because an organization in Copenhagen called Free Muse, which is like a kind of Amnesty International for musicians, asked me to write a report about how musicians were coping with the situation, with the ban on music. And I started writing, and I got so into it that instead of writing 10,000 words, I wrote 60,000.
Okay, that's quite an article.
Yeah, and just also getting into the whole the destruction of the mausoleums in Timbuktu, about what happened to other forms of art, like theatre, like film, and this kind of thing. So that's why it became quite an involved project.
Okay, when I met you, that was in 2003. It was the third edition of the festival in the desert. Then you were manager of Tahrif Tinariwen, the edification of the desert, a group that has become very known now. And I remember that people told about them that they made music, and it was in the beginning, it was distributed on cassettes.
Yeah.
And that people could be, well, arrested for having such a cassette, because the music was talking about standing up for your rights and things like that. So
that's also
a link between music and conflict.
Yes, that's true. In this book I've just written, I've concentrated on the last year, really, with a little bit of background, because otherwise the subject is so huge, and as I say, it was just a report that became a book. But you're right.
So you could add another book for each decision.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another book before and another, a prequel and a sequel. But yeah, I mean, Tinari Wen was, because as I've said, the struggle that Tinari Wen represented musically is deemed to be very dangerous by certain people, and especially by Algeria and by Mali, but also places like Niger. And, you know, each country has its own way of coping with this issue. Certainly in the 1970s and 1980s, when Tinari Wen were kind of beginning to exist and beginning to have a huge influence on Tuareg youth throughout the desert, it was deemed to be quite radical. Their message was deemed to be quite radical, quite politically dangerous. Now, whether you were arrested, I mean, I think maybe you could have been arrested, maybe you'd have to do something else to be actually arrested, or maybe people, but certainly cassettes were confiscated. I mean, I've heard that quite a few times, of people who had cassettes confiscated, or, you know, it just put you under suspicion if you had that kind of material in your possession.
Okay, I think our time is up. Thank you for being available on a Saturday afternoon, and when the next book is due, then we'll call you again.
That would be a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Bye, Andy.
Really enjoyed it. Cheers. Bye-bye.